2, 3, 4.
I think a good teacher is someone that comes to school not for the fact that they're getting paid and they come to school for the student.
It's a boy thing.
What I think makes a good teacher is a teacher that's willing to connect with their students, make an effort to get to know their students.
It's a boy thing.
Like when the teacher's approachable and you don't feel intimidated when you go up to talk to them.
It's a boy thing.
Kia ora.
Hi, how are you?
Kia ora, how are you?
I'm in a state of utter chaos, I think.
So funny because we got sent out yesterday by our AP the prize giving lists.
Oh my goodness. Like,
but the reality is the year is pretty much over. Like, let's face it, it is pretty much over now. And you know that everything when we get to this point, and you're talking about being a state of disarray, but it just snowballs, it accelerates. I'm holding on to the end now, so.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you counted the number of weeks that our senior students have left, in fact, it's not appropriate to count how many weeks are left because it's a very, very small number. And when I think about all the things that I want to achieve in that time, these are exercises in managing impossibility, isn't it, really?
No, I agree with you.
And one of the things that I find reassuring is I'm fortunate to work in a school where the students come to school. If I had to manage the absence of students on top of the fact that there's basically no time to get anything done anyway, it would just be ultimately impossible. And I must say, I guess a conclusion just to reach there, something I was discussing with my students today was showing up is half the battle, just being in the room.
Oh, I've been saying this to some of my students. Some of them want to get excellence, but they're not present. And they're asking, can they have more opportunities to attempt more writing portfolio pieces or whatever? And I'm going, no, you've already had 4 opportunities. If you are not at school, then this is the outcome that you will experience. Yeah. And that's it. I've been saying that also to my Year 9 boys. You know, you have to be here. It's been really fascinating for me because I have been seeing that particularly with one of my classes marking. They were like the sort of late finishers for one of the internal assessments and their results weren't what they possibly could have achieved. And I went, oh, my God, this is like, it was so clear to me. I mean, it sounds stupid that I'm saying this, but I was sitting there going, this is what happens if you don't turn up to school regularly.
Yeah, it's such a straightforward connection. It's really interesting, isn't it? I try and construct metaphors. There's a very well-known metaphor about all this, which is the one about the carrot being pulled out of the ground. Like if you keep pulling it out and measuring it, that doesn't promote growth. So when students are coming to us asking us to run additional assessment, that's not actually going to lead to them producing any better work. They have to actually do some learning and growth between those assessment sessions in order for there to be any change. If the assessment's accurate, then it's telling them what they're capable of. So I put it in the Olympics category. I said, well, it's a bit like running another Olympics because you didn't get a gold medal. Like, you're not going to get a gold medal tomorrow. You're going to have to spend the next 4 years training. And so it's the training, showing up, being there in those early mornings, waking up, using the disciplines, working hard, coming back to it after a setback. That's what leads to the excellent results, not just sort of being tested again.
Yes. Oh, man, that's so good. Like, often, you know how I often say to you, man, sometimes you can be so perceptive. That was one of those moments.
But it's almost like, it's like we keep trying to find new ways of saying exactly the same thing, which is come to class and do the work and the rest of it takes care of itself, which is all it is. But I mean, I think we can be proud to know that, I mean, one of the things we've been talking about a lot in the podcast is once they're in the door, how do you make the most productive use of their time so that it is of benefit to them? Like from the moment they enter the space to the moment they leave, how can we construct that time to get the best benefit? And of course, it does make sense that if we're doing that well, then their attendance takes care of the rest. And so good.
Yeah,
it's healthy.
No, that's good. After our last podcast, and I was talking about how my Year 9 boys were doing their speeches. And I had this really, actually it was kind of a profound moment. One of the boys, he was the last speaker, he'd been delaying doing his speech. And then I obviously, part of, I go stupidly, like had the epiphany, the realization that the reason why he was delaying doing the speech was because he was so, so nervous. Such anxiety over speaking in front of a group. So he's, I said, okay, it's your turn, you're going up. He sits there and he starts actually about to have a full-on panic attack. I think a lot of teachers in this moment would pull back and go, right, that's it, I'm out, I'm not going to push this kid to do it. I don't stop. So how do I do that? You're sort of holding in laughter with me or at me.
I'm just thinking about the times in our lives when we've reached that threshold and yes. then pushed where pushed. Everybody else steps back.
Yes, yeah. And so this is how it played out. I said, stand up the front and I'll get most of the class to put their heads down so that, you know, you are presenting, but you don't have eyes on you apart from Sam, who's recording, and myself. Couldn't do it. Honestly, deep breathing, stressing out. I was like, tears welling in the eyes. You can imagine what this looks like. Mm. I said, okay, could another student, a beautiful young man, can he go and stand up beside you at the front? And these are all tactics I've employed before just to get over that fear of speaking. No, still sitting there breathing, couldn't even process this. So I said, okay, let's pull it up on my computer and we will sit here. And I got everyone in the class apart from the boy that was on the other side of him and I was sitting on flanking him on his right-hand side. So everyone else in the room, heads down, and we read. So we did some almost kind of choral reading, which is obviously a great literacy strategy, where I said, you know, you and I will read together, or you and myself and the other student, we will read this together. So we were reading it together to the point where I went, you do it yourself now, you read it. And he read it himself, and it was reading. It wasn't a speech. It wasn't a presentation. But it was that moment where the student had a huge triumph because he actually was able to read something he had created in front of his peers. And I talked about this with a second-year teacher I have in the department. She went, oh, that's so good to know that you didn't give up and that you could actually get through kind of these steps and have that moment where the student actually did kind of present aloud but read aloud, which a lot of people would have just pulled back from and not, you know, pushed for. And he was so pleased. But also, you know, the most beautiful thing was the way in which his peers responded to him. So in the room, there were boys. I went up to the front. Lots of them were turning around saying, you did so well. They were high-fiving him. And I just honestly, like, it gives me a wee shiver thinking of it. It was such a special moment in the classroom. So I guess whilst it wasn't getting him up there and getting him speaking, because I know that in the past you have done things like had students come in and they've practiced and their lunch breaks so that they've got over those things, and I didn't have that time on my side because I didn't anticipate this response. At the same time, I guess I want to say to people who are listening, and if you're an English teacher, do believe that you can get your students to overcome that initial fear by simply getting them to actually read it with support, and then maybe they can move up the front next year and have a peer stand beside them, and the peer can then eventually move away or whatever. But it was a cool moment in the last 2 weeks.
Two thoughts come to mind immediately in relation to that. One is, talk about high press, high care. You know, we keep saying it. That's such a manifestation of that. Mm. You can't ask for that without caring that much. The students need both. Yeah. But the press is just as important as the care, isn't it? Like, just giving them the opt-out, like sanctioning withdrawing from the challenge, is essentially just embedding the problem. Whereas what you're saying, there's never an option not to do it. It's just how to get there. That's the job, is to work out how to get there. And the second thing that came to mind, I'm sure she won't mind, is Luella Harry. We've had a student in common in previous years. Who,
I love Luella.
Me too. And honestly, she had that challenge, you know, and it took her years to conquer it. But when she did, my goodness, she was awesome. Sometimes these things can be long durational, but we never stop asking.
Yeah, and I agree with you, but it was just such a really special moment.
For him, the imprint is I can conquer these moments. There are ways through. But also for the class at large, their response, and I understand how affected you were by it, but I actually think what they were doing was just responding to the behaviour that you were modelling. Mm. Essentially, the class gave the response you gave. Mm. You showed how to be around a person who's experiencing stress or anxiety, and so they knew how to be. And so often it's instructional on all sorts of different levels. Great teacher, great job.
Yeah, well, just a nice moment to share with people. Don't give up is my advice. You know, there are ways around this.
It's amazing how you have to hold those complex emotions. You have to hold them. You have to be the adult in the room. Mm. You have to be willing to tolerate the distress that sometimes occurs around learning. There's a lot of being big and carrying those things for young people that we have to do, I think.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing, isn't it? A lot of the times we are carrying a lot of the weight of our students. And that's why, obviously, teachers do care a lot, but they have sleepless nights and all that stress over things that a lot of people don't see, you know. Oh, teaching's whatever. Oh, you get all the holidays. Well, it's not. It's so much more than that. There's so much investment in every single individual that comes through the door.
And that's right. And there's 100 or so a day, and they're happening on a schedule of 50-minute periods, and they're cycling in and out. I had a moment yesterday where a student came in, looked a little bit flushed. I said, "How are you?" He just looked at me. It was obvious he wasn't okay. So I always, you know me, I just sort of verbalize what I see. So I said, "Oh, you're not okay." He burst into tears. Do you know what I mean? And it's like so fine for him to be not okay, but it's so important that we're able to be the counterpart to that, you know, like that we need to validate that for young people. And it takes confidence and courage on our side to be the right person in that moment.
And, you know, you're talking about also 100 odd kids a day caring for them. But that care doesn't stop also when they leave us. You know, this year I've had two students from different years of my teaching, who left in 2014, one who left in 2020, contact me so I could write references for them for things that they were doing. I know that I've communicated with you that one of my students from 2020, a hostel student from Mount Aspiring, has turned up at OBHS to do his teaching practicum. You know,
they keep coming back.
They keep coming back. And if you play that significant role and part in their life and you believe in them, then you continue to carry them once they've left you as well. It's sort of like they become a part of you, hey?
I had thought, and I think we should still, thought we might do a little bit of granular talk about actual practice in the classroom around the teaching of grammar for writing. Would you be up for that?
Would love to do that, and you know how much I love it.
So I thought we could talk about something we developed together, because then you'll have your own take on it. We came up with a grammar for writing practice around the writing of biography. And one of the fundamentals of grammar for writing is that it needs to be embedded in a rich and substantial context of its own. So you would never teach grammar in our classrooms as a decontextualized exercise. We would always have to make sure that there was a larger purpose. And so in this case, we had our young year 9 students write biographies of someone who was important in their lives. Often it was a grandparent or something like that. We'd set the project up by asking them to take a little voice recorder out and interview an important person and find out things about them and their history and their path through life. And then once they'd done that kind of initial research and gathered all of that audio, they then had to obviously transcribe that audio so that they had the material to work from. And that was essentially where the grammar for writing thing started. To do it well, the starting point is to work with the students on identifying features that are at a grammatical level that drive good writing in the genre you're working with. So for biography writing, in our case, we selected this really nice short biography of Stephen Adams, the basketballer. And as teachers, we interrogated that biography for the grammatical structures that sat within it that made it successful. And some of the grammatical structures were to do with the use of pronouns. There was verbs for and adverbs for time as well, because interestingly, that biography started in media res, so it started in the in this present moment.
Yes.
And Stephen Adams was described as he was kind of working the room in an old person's home who were playing a bingo game, so very kind of out of his normal context. And then it went back into a chronology of his history and how he came to be the successful basketballer he now is. So the sorts of things the boys were going to have to be able to do was to handle the shifting of tense within a single piece of writing. They were going to have to be able to describe and quote. They were going to have to be able to operate across those different timeframes in controlled and deliberate ways. And what we asked them to do, again, kind of the framing of it, is that they were to describe the situation where they were recording the interview with the person they cared about at the beginning of their biography. And then they would have to switch into a chronology of that person's life. So they were going to move from this present tense kind of first person moment into a third-person past tense narrative. That's quite a complex thing to do well, and to do that, there's grammar that drives it. And so we had to teach things like verbs for time and pronoun, first, second, third person, and the use of punctuation for quotation. And there was a whole lot of things we identified that were features of grammar that they needed to be fluent in order to successfully write these biographies. We also had to teach some of the structural features, like, you know, in media res and paragraph formation and that kind of thing. And so then, of course, what you do with grammar for writing, instead of just sort of using these big technical terms like I have been and spraying them around and hoping that they'll stick, is that we identify each of those grammatical forms. And once they understand that they are used in these texts and they need to be fluent in their use to be able to write like this, we then teach them systematically, one by one. So you might look at, for example, the use of verbs to manage tense, so to move from the present tense to the past tense. So you look at a series of verbs and then you play with those verbs and you give the students a number of activities still related or relevant to biography. So you create sentences that have verbs that would be biographical statements, but you start focusing on which word in this sentence is the verb, what tense is this sentence is, and what happens or how do you modify this word and this sentence to change it. You even get to the point where you do the verb declensions and you look at how different verbs shift form according to the tense that they're in. And so you will spend at least one lesson, possibly more, just exploring the nature of the relationship between verbs and tense, including introducing concepts like regular verbs, like the normal variation that is made, or the morphology of words to support the standard shift of tense. So the ed shifts a verb into the past tense, like I stop or I stopped. But then there are irregular methods of doing that, and English is full of these irregularities. So you also show that sometimes the past tense isn't represented by an ed, it might just be another different kind of modification, like run and ran. And so you actually teach it all and then make sure they know it. And then you return to the biography context and you start talking about where is this knowledge going to be important. And you have them understand that because they're moving from a present tense in media res instant, where they're describing that moment, where they're recording an interview with a parent or a grandparent or someone they value in their lives, to that chronology of their past and how they're gonna signal that in the language, what decisions do they have to make. And then you get them to practice that, shifting from tense to tense in pieces of writing. Give them a piece of writing in the present tense, say shift it into the past tense. But do that by first highlighting all the verbs and then putting them all in the past and seeing if that does the job, and are other complications introduced. And what's the effect of shifting something into the past tense? How does that change the way we perceive it? There's a million different discussion points that occur along the way. You ask them to discuss that. You ask them to experiment. You have a laugh. You explore why they've failed at times. Maybe they've, you know, changed it into the past tense, but the sentence no longer works in that tense. And then you discuss why it doesn't. And it might be because it has an auxiliary verb that also has to be shifted in tense. And it just goes on and on. Now, to do this well, Bags, as teachers, we've had to teach ourselves so much about grammar, grammatical meta-language, word morphology. There's just a million things that we actually have to have expertise in to successfully do this with a group of 13-year-olds. And I have to say, you can't expect to just walk into the class knowing it all, because if you're going to do this in the live context and it's experimental, like it must be to be grammar for writing, then you're going to encounter scenarios that just don't, that you don't know the answer to. And so that confidence as teachers to be flexible and to acknowledge when you don't know something really comes to the fore here. You have to kind of get over your bad self, as you often have said to me, and just accept that sometimes you'll reach a point of complexity that you don't know the answer to, but to be hungry for that knowledge in the way the students are and to find out and come back. I've had great moments in the Grammar for Writing teaching where the students have said, well, what about this? And I've gone, honestly, I haven't got a clue. I'll have to come back to you. And then, of course, you come back with this little golden artifact. You've done the research and they want to know. And suddenly you're having this really high-end conversation about grammar with a group of 13-year-olds, and it's a brilliant thing. And then essentially once you finish the whole thing, you ask them to put all of those different grammar effects together in the context of a piece of biographical writing, where you assess not just the quality of the writing as a global thing, but you actually identify each of those grammar effects and assess their effectiveness at employing these grammar effects for purpose within a piece of writing. But what the kids get from it, obviously, is a really well-written biography. And this time I'm definitely going to attach a couple of the ones that our students have written in Year 9 so that the listeners to this podcast can read what a Year 9 student can write when they're explicitly taught how to write it. Because it's been magnificent, hasn't it? Ironic. I just said to you we should talk about this and share ideas. I've done a 15-minute monologue. This is what it's like being in my class. We should discuss this, I say, which essentially is a cue for saying, I'm going to talk about this.
It's the Crush Show.
Yes.
No, but I loved what you did because, you know, again, Wednesday, you've got kids coming soon, so you're banging it out. But I think that my takeaway from doing the biographical writing, and I haven't done it yet this year at OB's, I did it last year at Queen's, to just say yes, the girls, and I know we're talking about boys, but actually this is really important to just talk about students at this point in time.
Yeah.
This was where I found the grammar for writing all came together. As in, they sort of, there was a real slow lag with a lot of things, and it got to the biographical piece, and man, it was like they just were able to grasp it. And I got some phenomenal pieces of writing that were like, whoa, these are incredible. And I like also you talking about having fun while teaching this. I think a lot of people probably think, whoa, man, that's really dry. God, your classrooms must be boring. Well, actually, no. Those moments where you're vulnerable with the students and you're writing up, for example, I'm thinking about other ones, other units that we've done, and we might be looking at complex sentences for the first time. And you get them to write up the complex sentences and changing around where you put the dependent or the independent clause. And the girls last year were writing up a whole raft of sentences on the board. And then we would collectively go, oh, is that actually a complex sentence or is it not? And sometimes I was stumped and I would go, I don't actually know. So then I'd go through and get my colleague, Viv, to come in, and she's, you know, really good with this stuff, and she would go, no, 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 that is, or no, that's not, and this is why. And so we'd have like a team teaching moment, which was also really cool and nice for the students to see that modeled as well. But I also think when you're talking about, so there's fun in that, but the fun also comes, it was when I was doing speeches and we were looking at modal verbs, and there was also allusions we used in the artist model that I used last year with the girls, and I said, oh, what was an illusion that I was trying to think about? And I said, all right, let's talk about when we were in COVID times, and Jacinda always, Ardern always said, and I was going to say the be kind, but then one of the girls, very good sense of humour, said the spread your legs thing from Chris Hipkins, which was hilarious. But then we applied modal verbs to the spread your legs. You might spread your legs. You must spread your legs. And we were in bits of laughter over how you actually apply modal verbs to this illusion. And then the girls said that they were going to go out and play with modal verbs with their teachers in response to their requests. I might do this. I could do this. And it was great. Like, who would think that modal verbs could be so fun? But they can actually be fun. The teaching can be fun. So those are just a few of the experiences that I've actually had with it. I've got a lot more, but you highlighted it perfectly, and I just kind of wanted to reinforce that it is fun. There are some days when you're only just a step ahead of the kids. I mean, you're further down this path and this on this journey than I am. I've still got a hell of a lot to learn, and I don't mind actually declaring that. But I must also say that, you know, I would never want to just pick up somebody else's program or work and then think I can run with it. If I'm not investing myself in it and learning about these things and creating my own resources, then how the hell am I going to deliver this effectively and so that it's meaningful and so that I can be a fantastic practitioner in terms of being that role model? I don't know at times, but also let's talk about the effects and really thinking through it. So it's such an awesome way to teach. I mean, I think about one of your colleagues, you keep saying that is that she's often said to you, I really feel like I'm teaching now. And I would agree wholeheartedly with that statement.
Yeah, it's a great feeling to sort of have something very precise that you want the students to get to and have a really well-defined path to getting there. And then actually seeing the students achieve the thing that you'd set up. So healthy and wonderful and so precise in English. And it doesn't stop us from having big picture conversations about themes. And in fact, it enables those conversations because we've got a lot more evidence to bring to the discussion. They're much more substantial. But I'd just finish this because my boys are just politely waiting outside the room. Just by saying we've also in the midst of that interregnum between the first and the second literacy co-requisite tests. And we've got those students, and we both celebrated the fact there's a lot fewer this year, but we still have students who didn't pass it the first time. And as a department, we've just came to the agreement just moments before this podcast, we are not going to do any rescue programs. We are going to stick to teaching good, strong literacy within the English classroom as part of the wider course, focusing on the things that those students obviously still need to learn, but not changing up the program or putting them in intervention sessions in order to get them through the test. It's about teaching the content well in the classroom. And so that was so exciting to have my team agree that that was our response.
And I love it as well. And I will say a final thing to enhance what you're saying, but we keep talking about from the very beginning podcast, high expectations. And I know that a lot of people would probably look at Grammar for Writing and think that it's quite complex. It's almost too challenging for year nine students. And I'm going to disagree. Mm. You know, the great thing about it is that English is so great at differentiating itself. And you can differentiate within the Grammar for Writing program, but also we have to have these high expectations and give our students really complex texts or ideas in order to extend them, but also to have that belief in them. And I think that that's important with what you're doing as a department, because I know that you've got the high expectations and that you are exposing your students to really complex texts, but the payoff is obviously, like, it's huge, the results you're getting. So bravo to you and your team. But, you know, thanks for sharing this with me and for the people who are listening.
Yeah, bravo to us all. Anyway, I would love to talk more, but I'm going to
go teach
my class. Bye. See you, Bags.
See ya.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a Boy Thing, a fortnightly chat about teaching English to boys with Gina and Chris.
It's when the teacher doesn't treat the students like their students, like they treat them like they're kind of like colleagues.
I think what makes a good teacher is clear set deadlines, good communication, willingness to like go over topics that some of us might find confusing,